All right, now it is time for the Berkshire Edge On Air. You can find the Berkshire Edge, theberkshireedge.com, of course, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we have Marcy and David joining us again this morning. Happy Halloween, you two.
Happy Halloween. David will be here in 30 seconds, but he is he's here. He's just getting his computer, so I'll start, and he will join us.
Well, all right. We'll wait for David to join us. We'll start off though.
We can start on the first story if you'd like.
Yeah, what's interesting is that here in Falls Village, there was a vigil after what happened in Pittsburgh, which was attended by over 100 people, and it was very quickly organized. And the first story that we have to talk about is the vigil for Pittsburgh planned by the Jewish Federation of the Berkshires.
Right. It's Thursday. There was a vigil. There have been some other vigils in the Berkshires. So I know there was a synagogue in Great Barrington that held something. Saturday evening. What day was the shooting? The shooting was Saturday morning, so they had something Saturday evening. But this is this one is an interfaith vigil that was organized by the Jewish Federation of the Berkshires. And I spoke to the executive director yesterday about it, and she said it was amazing that this was a coming together of the whole interfaith community, and it came together. You know, everyone wanted to participate. They're holding it at a synagogue in Pittsfield, a large synagogue in Pittsfield, which they thought it was appropriate that it should be in a synagogue, so that people feel what you know the fear of going into a synagogue these days. But So this is really going to be very large, I think. I don't know whether you were implying that it was, you know, it was long coming because they didn't pull it together until.
Oh no, not at all. No, that was not the implication. It was just that it's a really good thing to do at this time, and the more people, the merrier. And one of the really, you know, just how important it is to congregate.
Well, I'll show you
with actual
for Falls Village for individual residents to put this together in Falls Village and draw of 100-120 people in about 6 hours is absolutely amazing.
And it just shows the necessity and the timeliness. No, it has nothing to do with that whatsoever.
Yeah. Oh, right.
And in Falls Village it has to be interfaith.
Yes.
Speaking as a Falls Village resident. I promise you it was totally interfaith because one of the things that I think is just necessary in general conversation is when you are alone in your room playing with your screen talking to like-minded people, you end up in a very, very, very bad shape because there's nobody out there saying, you know, hey, that's not right, or that view has been sort of debunked, or. And
I you get into your own little echo chamber,
right, with others,
where everybody is reinforcing each other,
right, and terrible things happen, terrible.
Yeah.
And I just think that for everybody, not to minimize anything and not to deflect, but simply to say, hey, notice this, because it's something we can all do something about. And that's the bit that I think the vigil's really helpful with.
Oh, I do too, yeah. And,
people must begin to interact without their screens and with their fellow human beings. It goes much better, period. Just end of story.
Right. Well, you know, there was a two-part series on PBS last night and the night before, which I saw part of and which I've taped to watch. I mean, we've taped it, about Facebook, which was very interesting about, you know, the kind of divisions that have been created by social media. I mean, whether you know, not necessarily saying that it was intentional, but the way Facebook ran its business model, it has caused, you know, the ability for people like this to, you know, to talk only to each other.
Well, it's not only Facebook; it's Twitter. It's all of them rolled in together,
right.
where there's a lot of bravado, there's a lot of insightful commentary, and you know what? When you have people at the top and in
That's
parties
an
doing
drive.
Saying this thing, it's much easier to incite people to do crazy things. It's just a society we live in.
And people do it, and it's just it's something that is actually correctable, and I think the more people work on that, the better.
I want to get to your second story because I find this very interesting, and to see if it'll make Connecticut move at all, and that is the state of Massachusetts funding a pilot test to test a weekend only tourist oriented Berkshire Flyer train.
Right.
Well, can I break in?
Yeah,
there he is.
Of
it's the Great Pumpkin.
back from dropping kids at school.
That's right.
Well, this is a pilot. There have been for years. In 1971 was the last time that passenger service between the Berkshires and New York City directly was in existence. But since then, there's been freight service, but there's not been passenger service. So there's been a clamor for some kind of train to New York City, since a lot of people go to New York City and they drive to Wasaic in order to get, or to Hudson to get the train service. So this idea is the Berkshire Flyer is modeled after other tourist trains on the Cape and in Maine, where it's on weekend only, and this train, the Berkshire Flyer, would go from Pittsfield over to Rensselaer and then south to New York. So it's kind of a roundabout way.
To Rensselaer and then south to New York or south to Pittsfield?
South to New York City.
Right.
Oh. So it would go west and then go south. The more direct route, however, which is the one that has been the talk of many rail advocates in the Berkshires, is to go directly south along the old New Haven line, which is now owned by the Housatonic Railroad Company, which goes directly south from Pittsfield to Lenox, Stockbridge, Great Barrington, and into Connecticut, into Canaan, and then on to Danbury. So that would hit more Berkshire communities. But, it's expensive to rehabilitate that line. And while Massachusetts has committed money to doing so, Connecticut is not. Although I must say that in both cases, the state owns the rail lines or the track.
Yeah.
Connecticut owns the Housatonic Railroad from the state line down to Danbury, and Massachusetts owns the northern, their section of that line. So it would be more direct and hit more. More of the community, little towns. But on the other hand, it's expensive to upgrade it. That's the question.
Maybe with the sale of marijuana in Massachusetts, and maybe if we get the sale of marijuana in Connecticut, besides getting the legislature to smoke it, maybe we'll make enough money where you can pay for it.
Oh, wait a minute. You mean just designate it as certain amounts of sales tax are often sometimes designated to for education?
Yeah.
Or the pot train? Is that what you're saying?
I would think so. I think that would be about the only way that Connecticut's going to raise the money.
Yeah, Connecticut is in dire straits, I guess.
so to speak. Okay. All right.
On the wrong track.
There you go. That is exactly right. And, all right. Now we'll go on to story number three.
Yeah, we have a lot of stories this week because we didn't speak to you last week.
Well, the DA race and the nurses proposition, I mean, we've talked about it for weeks now, but now the big test is coming up next week.
The big test is coming up next week.
Yeah.
And the nurses one is particularly dramatic lately because, this is a proposal supported by one of the nurses' unions that staffing, a certain staffing level be required in all cases And at first, it seemed very popular, but we heard polls yesterday that the support for this has really gone down, and it's now only about 30% of the electorate is interested in or is supporting this. So it's been a big shift in the last month or so. And the argument has been that, you know, you can't legislate nursing staffing levels, that hospitals have to be free to make those decisions. There are several other nursing associations that are against it, with the arguments that hospitals would have to close down certain kinds of services, that they would, you know, especially in the middle of an opioid crisis, they would be closing beds for the treatment of opioid emergency cases because they wouldn't have enough nurses on staff. So I think this is going to lose. All indications are it's going to lose, although it seemed to have very good prospects in the beginning. The second issue of the DA race, as you know, Andrea Harrington won the primary, but the incumbent who lost is now running a write-in campaign. And we have been getting letters from both sides, but primarily in support of Andrea Harrington, who has been running a very strong campaign. So, you know, everybody is wondering how that, you know, did this, you know, it's a big topic of discussion here.
Well, as someone who who ran a campaign for the Board of Education and ran as not as a Democrat or Republican or an independent, but just a petitioning candidate, and I was on the ballot, okay? Mm-hmm. You didn't have to write my name. It was, I lost by a little over 100 and some votes to a very strong Democratic candidate. What?
Is he a write-in?
No, they were on the ballot, you know, the regular Democratic ballot. So,
right.
And it's that much harder if you're a write-in, never mind, you know, if you're not on the ballot and somebody has to write in your name, it's really very, and Amenia, it happened. I think it was Amenia where somebody did a write-in campaign to become the town Department of Public Works head, and they won. But it's a very hard thing to do. It really is.
Yeah.
Well, but in this case, it's interesting. This is interesting for no other reasons. For one, Andrea Harrington is being supported by a network of women who have been very politically very astute and successful in getting their candidates elected. In fact, the mayor of Pittsfield is one of the products of this network.
And she's endorsed Andrew,
yeah,
of course.
And so I would not underestimate it. It's kind of under the radar a little bit, but it's there. On the other hand, so-called incumbent, we must say that in this case, the longtime district attorney David Capeless resigned a few months ago in order to get his deputy and designated heir appointed acting DA. And so he's the candidate that's going to be in a write-in, who's the write-in candidate. Excuse me. So this is an unusual situation.
And it's unusual in that the original DA actually filed papers to run again in February, and then he resigned in March. So he was trying to throw everybody off track. So he filed papers that he was going to run, and then suddenly he announced he was resigning, and he was appointing his deputy to be the incumbent. So, you know, so it's been kind of tricky.
Well, you know, I've got to say that, you know, you can't. Well, the women who are backing Andrea Harrington, not only women, but it's the organizers are effective. Nevertheless, you can't underestimate the political machine, the long-time political machine in Pittsfield.
The GOP,
which is Democratic and has, Democrats, and they are not to be not to be sneezed at. So
that's the GOBN, the Good Old Boys Network.
Yes, it sure is.
Well,
Pittsfield has been run by that for ever since. Well, it goes way back to General Electric running the town. That's all I can say.
All right. So, well, we have about 6 minutes left, and we have.
Oh, that's all.
Well, okay.
We have a bunch of stories still to go. I mean,
people have to go to the edge and read them.
That's right. That's right. What we cover is just a fraction. What you'll find at the BerkshireEdge.com. But you've got this profile that's coming up.
Oh yes, this is a very interesting woman, Mary Loeb Gendler, and this is really just kind of a break from the storm and drum of everyday life to contemplate a woman who has led a contemplative life, really, who graduated from college, wasn't sure what she was going to do, went to a lecture given by a rabbi named Everett Gendler, fell in love with him and married him, and you know they have been living in the Berkshires for a very long time. But she became a rabbi's wife in New Jersey, but they have been political activists all their lives, and they traveled to Selma with Martin Luther King. They have been supporting other kinds of causes, but when they started to retire, they went to Asia, they eventually went to Tibet. They became very involved in the plight of the Tibetan people. And for the last 20 years, they have been supporting the cause of the Tibetans who are trying to free themselves from Chinese domination. And they have become very good friends with the Dalai Lama, who we have a photo of the Gendlers and the Dalai Lama lighting Hanukkah candles together in 1995. But this is a lovely story of a woman who has led a meaningful life, who has always cared and always been concerned, always found causes that made a difference. It's a lovely profile of people who have convictions and have stuck by them through their whole lives.
All right. Now, they also had a four-part series on addiction, and now the author wrote a finale for this.
Yes, she did, Sheila Clary. And the finale, actually, is she went to a journalism class. It turned out that this story about Sarah, who had become a heroin addict, had really got the attention of high school students. And so Sheila, the author, went to conducted a journalism class in the high school, in which the students were asking the most intriguing questions and perceptive questions about how you write a story such as this, and how you get a story where you're basically. You're not revealing the identity of this person, but you're telling the narrative anyway, and it's a real interesting. I was quite surprised to see how many students actually were really on top of this story, because you just don't know who's reading it really, but apparently this is a big concern among students.
All right, I want to move on because we have two stories I want to get both. We're only going to have about a minute and a half on each, and that is STEM Week winding up at Monument Valley Middle School.
Oh, yeah, that's another story by Sheila Clara. She was she went and profiled a program, a week-long program at the middle school here in Great Barrington, in which they're doing the STEM. They were encouraging students to do STEM projects, which is science, technology, engineering, and math. There were a lot of girls doing it, which I thought was great. That was our lead photo, was the girls involved in this kind of hands-on scientific experimentation. So that was a really fascinating story, and It's good for the school for incorporating that kind of education into their curriculum.
All right, and you've got another story which I have read, by the way, and that is Massachusetts has designated Great Barrington as a cultural district.
You know, big surprise, right? It's about time, actually. It's a designation that honors the Mehewee Theater and St. James Place, which are major attractions. Also, I must say, Lauren Clark Gallery as a cultural district. It's a designation that Great Barrington deserves, I think, especially in the Berkshires, which is whose reputation and character really has focused on cultural venues such as Tanglewood and Jacob's Pillow and the theaters.
I also think it helps that Great Barrington is compact in a town than the way it's laid out. And from one end of the town to the, actually from the Mehewee to the St. James Place, is not a very large walk. I think it's the whole atmosphere of the town that helps with that as well.
Yeah, it is. I mean, and we have lots of restaurants, lots of nice little artisan shops, two major cultural performing arts venues. You know, it is a cultural center.
All right.
And a movie theater, you know, a four-screen movie theater. Tucked away and right off of Main Street, so there really is a lot going on in downtown.
All right, so that's just a fraction of the stories that you'll find.
Just a fraction.
That's right. You got to go to
theberkshireridge.com and we'll speak to you guys next week.
Okay. You bet. Okay. Thanks.
Right. Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And once again, you can find them at theberkshireedge.com.